Hi, friends, and welcome to Reading Jewish History in the Parsha, where each week we share an idea on the Parsha and how it relates to Jewish history, along with all the books and articles I've read over Shabbos to learn more about it. Reminder to sign up for our weekly email, readingjewishhistoryintheparsha.substack.com, where you can get a write-up of our weekly class, along with all of the links to the articles and books that I have discovered on my Shabbos reading journeys. Thank you so much to our friends and sponsors, Janet and Lior Hode and family, with immense gratitude to Hashem. If someone asked you to study any aspect of Jewish law, where would you begin? I'm not just talking about how you would introduce someone to Judaism, but which area of in-depth Torah study would you begin with? It's always a fascinating question because it forces people to consider how Torah moves them and shapes their own Jewish identity. I remember I once asked this question to Rabbi Eliezer Breidowitz, the Rosh Yeshiva of Darchei Torah in Toronto, and he actually answered the laws of Lashon Hara, negative speech. It was a fairly unexpected answer, but I've come to appreciate it more and more. On some outreach programs, they deliberately begin with the laws of damages and Seder Nezikin, which nicely highlight the rhythm and internal logic of Talmudic discussions. I would begin with the laws of Geirus, conversion. Not because I think people should convert to Judaism or have some sort of plan B if they fall in love with a non-Jew so they could convert them, but rather because I think the laws of conversion most clearly express what Jewish faith, Jewish law, and Jewish family are all about. It's also fairly easy to explore. There are three major passages in the Talmud that form the basis for nearly all the laws of conversion. The first is the longest discussion, appears in Tractate Yevamos 46a to 49b. You can look it up. Of course, we link to it in our weekly write-up that you can get on Substack, Reading Jewish History in the Parsha.substack.com. We link to the Safari and all the other articles we quote, where the Talmud in Yevamos outlines the basic procedure for Jewish conversion: circumcision for males, immersion into a mikveh, a ritual bath, and finally a special sacrifice was offered in the time of the temple. I actually wrote about the more intrinsic connection between Tractate Yevamos, which discusses Levirate marriage, if you know what that is, and the laws of conversion in my ongoing Talmud essay series for Tablet. You can read that. The title's called Family Ties. I'm proud of that essay. The other major passage in the Talmud is in Kesubos on 11a, and that talks about how young children are converted to Judaism. And then finally, the Talmud in Tractate Krisus on 9a, there's a foundational discussion that explains that all of the laws of conversion are derived from the experience of the Jewish people at Mount Sinai. There is one other essential rule for conversion, and this is the one that has made conversion so tricky to navigate, namely that the conversion must take place in front of a Beis Din, a formal Jewish court. The Talmud derives the requirement for a Beis Din, a Jewish conversion, from a verse in our Parsha, Parshas Emor, where the Torah writes, Mishpat Echad Yihye Lachem Kager Ka Ezrach Yihye Ki Ani Hashem Elokeichem. It's one Mishpat, one law for the convert. And the Talmud in Kiddushin derives from this that, like Mishpat, like law, a Beis Din, a formal Jewish court, is also required to supervise Jewish conversion. The context of this Talmudic passage is really important. In the course of discussing whether a prospective convert has agency to perform their own conversion, it's a term the Talmud calls biyado. Is it in their hand? Do they have their agency? The Talmud explains that conversion is not a status that people are considered to have agency over because of this requirement for a Beis Din. If a Beis Din is required to convert, the Talmud reasons, who says that those three will be available to him? You don't always have it within your control to assemble a Beis Din. That is essentially what the Talmud says and why conversion is not considered something that you have agency over. But like, really? This is why conversion is not considered something that can be performed on its own? Because it may be too difficult to assemble three Jews together to serve on a Beis Din? Why does the Talmud assume this will be such a challenging condition for conversion? A smart convert could just put up a sign that says free food outside of a mikveh and wait for Jews to gather. Once they do, just jump in and there's your Beis Din. Who says you can't convene a Beis Din without their knowledge or consent? Just jump into a mikveh in front of three Jews. Instead of saying cannonball, shout for the sake of Jewish conversion and jump in. To understand the nature of conversion and the requirement of Beis Din, let's explore some of the history of Jewish conversion. In many ways, questions related to Jewish conversion are quite modern. This is for a few reasons. Firstly, for much of the Middle Ages, particularly in the Christian world, it was forbidden for a Gentile to convert to Judaism. In fact, in many works published about the laws of conversion, the censor required them to add a disclaimer that such legal processes are no longer in use. Some older works republished today, like certain editions of the Shulchan Aruch, or the later work known as the Aruch HaShulchan, I know they sound the same, they're different works, still include the censor's disclaimer that conversion to Judaism is no longer practiced. If you open up an Aruch HaShulchan to the section of Yoredeya to the laws of conversion, which are in 268, Reish Samaches, the title is as follows: Dine Gerim Biyamim HaKadmonim, the laws of conversion in the ancient times, in the earlier days. And then it adds, Ubim Bedino Seinu, and in our country, Ein Lanu Rishos LaKabel Gerim, we do not have permission to accept converts to Judaism, Medina de Malchusa, because of the government laws. Rav Moshe Feinstein actually explains a stringent ruling of Rav Akiva Eger regarding teaching Torah to prospective converts in light of this historical reality. Rav Akiva Eger, in his responsa, number 41, rules that the prohibition of teaching a non-Jew Torah even applies to prospective converts. You can't teach a convert Torah. So how are they supposed to convert? How are they supposed to know anything? So Rav Moshe Feinstein explains, and you can look that up in the third volume of his responsa, known as Igros Moshe, on Yoredeya, and it is responsa number 90 in that third section, Simen Tzadi. Rav Moshe Feinstein explains that Rav Akiva Eger's ruling must have referred to a time and place where Jewish conversion was prohibited. So teaching a conversion candidate Torah would not necessarily materialize to an actual conversion. So they just said, don't even bother. Don't teach Torah. You're not allowed to teach Torah to a non-Jew, and that even includes a prospective convert, because at that time, when somebody would come to convert, most of the time they wouldn't see it through because it was absolutely illegal. There is another more essential reading why issues related to conversion are decidedly modern, and that is because the very notion of changing one's religious identity is a product of modernity itself. As David Ellenson and Daniel Gordas argue in their fascinating work, Pledges of Jewish Allegiance, Conversion, Law, and Policymaking in 19th and 20th Century Orthodox Responsa, it really is a fascinating work. They write as follows: modernity has dissolved the synonymity of status and identity. As they explain, the state of pre-modern Jewry was quite different from the world we now take for granted. This is how they explain it. The Jewish community was politically autonomous or semi-autonomous in governing the lives of its members, and it informed their sense of self-identity even as they internalized the cultural norms and teachings of the community. There was little or no distance between the public and private spheres, or between individual and collective realms with regard to Jewish status and identity. In a world where pluralism was controlled politically in such matters, and where individualism and voluntarism had not yet arisen as they have in a modern setting, being Jewish was more than expression of religious affiliation. It defined a person's political status, informed his culture, and determined his identity. Being a member of the Jewish collective was not a matter that was subject to an individual's own beliefs or desires, but was dictated by the rules of Jewish law and the communal structures that enforced them. The establishment of the State of Israel magnified the Jewish conversion questions that modernity had already brought to the fore. In particular, Israel's right of return, guaranteeing Israeli citizenship to anyone who is Jewish, raised the obvious but somewhat intractable question: so who is a Jew? Meaning, according to whose definition of Jewish identity, and who decides the procedures for Jewish conversion? In 1958, a decade after the establishment of the State of Israel, David Ben-Gurion, Israel's first prime minister, posed this question to over 50 Jewish leaders from across the spectrum. He sent letters to leading Rosh Yeshiva, rabbis, and scholars. The responses were later collected and published as a book entitled Jewish Identity, Who is a Jew? It's a fascinating work of Jewish law, history, and policy. You'll see answers there from Rav Aaron Cutler, of Moshe Feinstein. Rabbi Soloveitchik wrote one with Rav Chaim Heller, the Lubavitcher Soloveitcher Rebbe wrote one with 1,000 follow-ups. Also, non-Orthodox scholars, it's a fascinating work. Israel certainly has not found the perfect answer to this question, but the centralized chief rabbin in Israel has essentially managed to preserve the traditional definition of Jewish identity, being either born of a Jewish mother or a product of a halachic conversion. Whereas in Israel, the difficulty was finding a standard that would work for an entire country, Jewish conversion in the United States was beset with a different set of problems. American Judaism has always been shaped by America's commitment to freedom of religion, which has drastically reshaped the contours of American Judaism. In America, there is no chief rabbinate, not for lack of trying. We've tried a bunch of times, they've always failed. But there's no chief rabbinate to centralize fundamental questions of Jewish identity and conversion procedures. In the absence of any centralizing authority on Jewish conversion, and still unresolved issues among the different American denominations on the binding nature of Jewish law and its interpretation, rabbis from different denominations have differed on the very definition of Jewish identity. So like it is today, each denomination conducts its own Jewish conversion procedures. Non-Orthodox conversions are generally not accepted by the Orthodox community, leaving many Jews in limbo regarding the very nature of their Jewish identity. In 1977, a group of rabbis in Denver, Colorado, from across the denominational spectrum, wanted to change the way Jewish conversions were performed in the United States. It was simply not tenable, they reasoned, to have Jews considered Jewish in some denominations, but not others. Instead, this group of 9 rabbis, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, were all represented, experimented with a jointly developed Jewish conversion program. Every rabbi would have to compromise. Orthodox rabbis would have to be willing to tailor their standards for a wider audience, while the non-Orthodox would have to become comfortable on insisting on a conversion standard their movement simply did not require. It was an ambitious vision that ended in total disaster. Rabbi Daniel Goldberger, one of the Orthodox rabbis involved in the joint conversion Beis Din, characterized his feelings about his involvement as guilt, guilt, guilt. He began to analyze the conversion candidates. Out of 130 candidates, 94 had been recommended by the Reform rabbis. Just 8 came from the Orthodox rabbis. It was becoming harder and harder to justify Orthodox participation. It felt to Rabbi Goldberger that the Orthodox participation was just in effect giving a stamp of approval to Reform conversion standards. The tension was further exacerbated when in March of 1982, the Reform movement formally recognized patrilineal descent, giving Jewish status to anyone born with a Jewish parent, regardless of whether it was from the father or the mother. This break from over 2 millennia of tradition created what seemed like an unbridgeable chasm between Orthodox and Reform definitions of Judaism. In the early summer of 1983, Rabbi Goldberger and the other Orthodox rabbis finally had enough. It felt like they were compromising far more than their non-Orthodox colleagues. The Orthodox rabbis informed their non-Orthodox colleague that they planned on leaving the joint Beis Din. Word quickly spread within the Orthodox about Denver's conversion experiment. Condemnations came from across the Orthodox world. Rabbi Meir Kahana, the Allgemeiner Journal, Agudas Yisrael's Jewish Observer, my favorite magazine, all ran editorials decrying what they saw as a flagrant compromise of Orthodoxy's values. All of Denver's participating Orthodox rabbis were summoned to a disciplinary hearing from the Rabbinical Council of America, the Orthodox umbrella group of which they were all members. In March of 1984, the New York Times ran a story covering the fallout entitled Rabbi's Denver Project Fuels Fight on Converts. And of course, in case you were wondering, we link to that New York Times article in our weekly email, readingjewishhistoryintheparsha.substack.com. An entire chapter is dedicated to the story of Denver in Samuel G. Friedman's must-read incredible work. If you haven't read it already, I don't even believe you. You must read this book. I've read it multiple times, and it is called Jew vs. Jew, The Struggle for the Soul of American Judaism. This has only become more and more relevant. Friedman summarizes the speculative theories that different parties offer to explain the fallout from this joint Beis Din. He writes, various theories, none of them entirely correct, laid the blame for the Denver program's demise on different factions. One version condemned the ultra-Orthodox for their ferocious criticism, but that criticism only came after the fact. Another indicted the Reform movement for having adopted patrilineality, but that ignored problems inherent in the Denver system from its genesis. The Joint Conversion Panel collapsed under the weight of its own contradictions, fundamental differences in doctrine that no amount of belief in Klal Yisrael could wish away. The lesson that we learn from this six-year experiment, Rabbi Wagner, one of the Orthodox rabbis, said in 1984, was that it's erroneous to build the idea of Jewish unity on religious or ideological compromise. Put another way, Denver discovered it was easier to change a Jew's status than a Jew's soul. In a sense, the failure of Denver's joint Beis Din for conversion highlighted the underlying tension that animated much of Jewish life, particularly in America, the tension between Judaism as a religion versus Judaism as a people. As Jonathan Sarna artfully explains in his classic work, American Judaism, A History, he writes as follows: the tension between these two visions, the one focused on Judaism and faith, the other on Jewishness and peoplehood, would characterize American Jewish life throughout the 20th century, inspiring a great deal of disputation, but no permanent resolution. And this brings us back to the role of Beis Din for conversion. The role of Beis Din for conversion is different than any other form of Beis Din. An essential part of Jewish conversion is joining the Jewish people. In fact, as Rav Shlomo Fisher explains in a powerful essay in his work, Beis Yishai, Judaism began as a family and only afterwards became a religion. Our forefathers and all those who lived before Sinai, Rav Fisher explains, were part of the Jewish family, even though the former obligations of the religion of Judaism only began at Sinai. Conversion to Judaism, therefore, begins by joining a people rather than affirming a specific religious ideology. It is through joining the Jewish people, becoming a part of the Jewish family, that our religious obligations and responsibilities descend and emerge from within us. That is why the Talmud refers to converts as a child reborn. Ger shenes geyer kekutin shenola dummy. A Jewish conversion is tantamount to being reborn within the Jewish family. How does one gain acceptance from the Jewish people, though? Do you have to ask every Jew individually? This is why the Beis Din for Jewish conversion is so essential. As Rav Shaul Yisraeli, the former Rosh Yeshiva of Merkaz Harav and member of Israel's Central Beis Din, explains, the Beis Din for conversion represents the Jewish people themselves. This is why, as opposed to most other forms of Beis Din, a Beis Din for conversion needs to be convened willingly. Who says you'll be able to convene three people, the Talmud asks regarding a Beis Din for conversion. The Talmud's concern is specific to the Beis Din of conversion, where simply jumping into a mikveh in front of three unsuspecting Jews is not enough. Since the Beis Din represents the very acceptance of the Jewish people, their consent and willingness to serve in such a capacity is paramount. Hayesod ha'ikri ha'machriya begerusu, writes Rav Yisraeli in the original, and you can find this in his responsa, which are known as Chavos Binyamin, Simin Samech Zion 67. And he writes there, Hayesod ha'ikari ha'machriya begerusu efo ha'knisa l'klal Yisrael, mishum zehu tzarech shlosha shehein Beis Din, shemakablon oso bahaska maso, v'ha'pa'ula mitzido eino ela tana'im hechrechiyim lebitoy ha'haskama mitzido. The religious obligations of Judaism and the notion of Jewish family and peoplehood are inexorably connected. It is impossible to join just the religion and discard the family in the same way it is impossible to join the Jewish family but ignore the religious obligations that come along with it. When Rav Shlomo Goren was asked if it is possible to become a part of the Jewish religion without joining the Jewish people, his answer was an unequivocal no. The Jewish faith and the Jewish people are bound together. And this is why the laws of conversion are so powerful. The entryway into Jewish life and identity illuminates the entire nature of the Jewish experience itself. We are a family, and like every family, we have familial obligations and responsibilities. And it is the eternal existence of the Jewish family, with all of our religious obligations, that we will continue to survive, thrive, and bring light to the entire world. So thank you again for listening to Reading Jewish History in the Parsha. To get the links to all of the articles and books mentioned, be sure to subscribe to our weekly Substack, Reading Jewish History in the Parsha.substack.com. Thank you again to our sponsors, Janet and Lior Hode and family. With immense gratitude to Hashem, I am so grateful for your friendship. Thank you so much for listening, and keep reading each and every Shabbos.